Says that Lois Wilson was asked one time what she does in a moment of silence. And she asked God to join us for the meeting. And if y'all would, let's take a moment. Let's invite our higher powers to the meeting. And let's say a little prayer for our speakers today. Serenity prayer. God, give us some serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Well, if you know my wife, she, Chrissy came to me, I don't know, she said, you're hosting one of the speakers. She didn't ask if I wanted to, she said I was going to. And I jumped all over the opportunity for Cliff, and I got to hear Cliff at the Appalachian Roundup a couple years ago, and he did step one, and man, it was powerful. And I don't know about you guys, I love speaker CDs, and I get wrapped up in them, and I've been listening to his talks for the last month, and I love him. And we even started telling each other we loved each other already. And I don't know if y'all been watching him, man. He's bouncing everywhere, all over the place. And he's just, if I don't know anything else about Cliff, he loves Alcoholics Anonymous, and he loves alcoholics. And I'm looking so forward to listening to him this morning on steps two and three. My home group is the Maladjusted to Life group. Isn't that great? Moving on to steps two and three, we found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. Big Book, Alcoholics Anonymous, page 46. Please help me welcome from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, Cliff G.
I'm Cliff Gooding. I'm a grateful alcoholic. I'm sober since August the 15th of 2001, and for that short amount of time, I'm as grateful as I know how to be. And, man, it's great to be in Tennessee today and with all you. This is one of the best-looking bunch of sick people I've seen in a while. So I want to thank Chrissy for extending the invitation for me to be here this weekend. I want to thank my beautiful wife, Lori, who many of you know, who's one of those highly organized armed Al-Anons that are here today. And for making the trip with me and coming out. A lot of my friends here this weekend, and it's just exciting to be here. I really don't have that much to say today, but it's going to take me about an hour to say it, I think. And so just a great lineup of speakers. Vivian got us kicked off last night. Beautiful. Thank you so much, Vivian. I really am excited because Leslie's here. She has low energy, but she can. We'll try to pump her up sometime during the weekend, get her going. Maybe, I don't know. So, and my good friend John, who's just been a man, just such a good friend of mine. For he and his wife Renee, and I've been Lori and I've been guests in their home, and it's just good to be with you this weekend, my friend. And Steve, who I've known for almost a big chunk of my sobriety, and just. Who I love dearly, and Steve and I got to spend about an hour or so this morning just sitting and talking and drinking coffee and catching up, and finally at 8:10 I said, I got to go, I got to get ready, I can't do this in my PJs, so I had to go, and it's just that, I mean, it's just that, and I know you experience that when you get here, because you all come here just like all of us do, and you get connected back, maybe people you haven't seen in a year or 6 months or some period of time, and you get reconnected, and it's like you pick the conversation up where you left off. It's like, that's what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous. You can walk into an AA meeting in a room full of complete strangers and begin to reminisce. Just pick up like the conversation has flowed forever. And that's the beautiful part about us. I mean, this connectedness that we have through this tremendous collapse that we've had, we get connected. And that great connection that we have, that power that permeates the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous shows up for us. And so when we get here, when we do things like this, when we get together, birthdays, anniversaries, conferences, when we do things like that, we come to remember. We really come to these things to remember, to see. You know, the speakers become kind of incidental to these things. We come to remember. We get together to remember those early times in alcohol, those early days for all of us in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new or you're nearly new in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you don't hear anything else I say today, and if you're new or you're nearly new, you might not. But if you don't hear anything else, hear this. that you're wanted, welcome, and needed in Alcoholics Anonymous, okay? That you're absolutely wanted, welcome, and need here. Vivian said, started her talk off last night with talking about Clancy and talking about that talk he gave all those years ago about this disease of perception. And isn't that true for us, this perceptive problem that we have? But isn't it true for the people who love us as well? I mean, if you look at it from the perspective of the people who love us, they look at us and they say things like this: if you'll quit drinking, your life will get better. Because that's their experience. Their experience is they can take it or leave it. And they have this perception of us that if we just stop drinking, that somehow everything will be okay. The great illusion and delusion of people who are not alcoholic, they form this idea that our problem is alcohol. And again, to the whole world, that certainly is what it looks like. I mean, to the whole world, it looks like if an alcoholic stops drinking, then all will be all right. Everything will be okay. The trouble with alcoholism and alcoholics, we don't come with warning labels, right? I mean, there's no warning label that says, caution, annihilation of everything worthwhile in life follows. I mean, it doesn't say that, right? It doesn't talk about the warped lives of blameless children that is soon coming behind that. It doesn't talk about sweet relationships destroyed. Yeah. No warning label on it. And look at it from the perspective of the alcoholic. The alcoholic, when they hear that, they think, man, you don't understand. And out from the alcoholic's perspective, the thought is, look, I get that. I understand when intellectually that if I stop drinking, you believe my life will get better. And in those moments of guilt, remorse, and shame early on when they're lecturing us, although they don't mean to, when they're giving us the frothy emotional pill, that sounds legitimate. If I stop drinking, I'll be okay. It's the amazing dualistic perspectives of these two people. The non-alcoholic perspective is if you just quit drinking, it'll be all right. And the alcoholic perspective is that when I stop drinking, it's when it really gets bad. You know, if you're a real alcoholic, as described in our book that it talks about so eloquently, that while alcohol appears to be the problem to the entire world, that Vivian laid out beautifully for us last night. And by the way, if you're new and you hear this talk this weekend and you go home to your people and said, that guy from Oklahoma City said booze wasn't a problem, you know, they will probably hunt me down. Pitchforks, you know. But our textbook tells us that the bottles were just a symbol for us. Because when I'm not drinking, that's when the manifestation of what really is wrong with me, the real problem, begins to surface. And how do you describe that? How do you describe, because I certainly knew when I was brand new or before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, while I knew these words, I couldn't put that together to describe how I felt. I couldn't describe restless, irritable discontent. Now, when I heard that for the very first time in a meeting of alcoholics, and I thought, man, that guy's a genius right there, right? I didn't know he was cheating and reading out of the book, right? But that so eloquently describes what happens to me when I'm not drinking. The spiritual malady. That part of me that just kind of churns. That part of me that somehow or another separates myself from you. That part of me that's full of couldas, wouldas, shouldas. You know? That part of me that talks to me. That part of me of alcoholism. I don't know how alcoholism affects you in your life. But alcoholism never shows up at 2 in the afternoon. It's always 2 in the morning. Cliff, we've been up for an hour. We need to get you in the game, man, you know? And they got a lot of information for me at 2 in the morning, right? I mean, and really they just mostly want me to listen, not participate. And it's all that part of our book on page 52 where Wilson describes the bedevilments, this bedeviled life I have. And I don't know how do you tell somebody that? How do you look at somebody across the table from you that you are just burning? You're taking that hostage with you on the journey to destruction. How do you sit across the table from them when they're telling you, look, if you just stop drinking, it'll be better? How do you describe that to them? How do you articulate what's really going on inside of you? How do you gather up the forces and the words? I mean, I talk for a living. And I couldn't formulate the words to describe to the people sitting across from me the internal condition of my life. Because everybody in this room who identifies himself as an alcoholic understands the problem of alcoholism really starts for us where booze ends. That spiritual malady. And it just pervades my life. And if I look back at it, you know, it has had an onset with me, it seems like forever. It seems like when I went to kindergarten for the first day, and my mama had me there early. I mean, she had me spit shined, you know. And she took me to that little red schoolhouse, and when she opened the door, we went in, there was probably, I don't know, maybe 15 kids at those little bitty round tables, you know. And we went in, and those kids' heads popped up, and instantly it became all about me. I don't fit in with these kids, right? And I don't know that I've necessarily thought that. I had these feelings that I'm somehow or another, I'm different from these kids. I'm less than. It's this idea that, you know, that somehow I'm just different. And when I found alcohol and I drank for the very first time, that just went away. That restless, irritable discontentedness, the bedeviled piece of me, that separateness of me, it was really a spiritual experience for us, right? That initial drink that abates that malady, it really is a spiritual experience. And Dr. Jung, in his letter to Bill in the 60s, when Bill wrote him about, you know, on the 25th anniversary, I believe it was, of Alcoholics Anonymous, to say, hey, you remember Roland, he came to see you, and he writes back, yes, I do remember Roland, he's an alcoholic, and he talks about the thirst of the alcoholic. And you can go Google that letter, just Wilson Jung letters, you can find these, they're beautifully written. You know. And you said, you know, the thirst of an alcoholic on a kind of a primal level is this search for God. Yeah. Spiritus contra spiritum, whiskey versus God. And so for us, that initial drink is this spiritual experience. And what it did for a guy like me is when I begin to drink, I separate myself more. It instills the delusion in me that I really am different. It just preys, the committee in the head begins to really tell me that, hey, yeah, you really are different from these people. And they're all talking about you. They don't want you around. You're different from. And so a couple things happen. I become a recluse, or I exaggerate my personality to become part of. I become the class clown, or I become the recluse of the school. But whatever that is, I try to either redefine myself as to be over-exaggerated or disappear inside of all that. And all of us have had those extremes of how that feels for us, not under the influence of alcohol. The malady. And I'm a fundamental believer that when we look at steps 2 and 3, really those first 3 steps, and I kind of look at Alcoholics Anonymous, these 12 steps, as kind of, there's 4 kind of cornerstones, I believe, in that. The first of those cornerstones are embodied in the first 3 steps, and that is getting right with God. Steps 4 through 7 are about getting right with self. 8, 9, 10, getting right with others. And 11, 12, the cornerstone is a life of service. And so my task today is to kind of talk about that getting right with God piece. The first of that was laid down by Vivian last night. And so my task today is to talk about these other 2 pieces of getting right with God. And how do we do that? Because certainly when I come here, you know, you're offering a solution that I'm not really interested in. You know, I don't really am interested in that because I know about that and it doesn't work for me. You know, I know about God. I mean, I'm a guy that when I was a little kid, I grew up in a Southern Baptist church. And nothing wrong with that, certainly. If you're that, that's wonderful. But I can't hear it from them. Because I can remember that old Sunday school teacher talking about, if you're thinking about it, it's as bad as doing it. And I'm sitting in Sunday school with those little girls thinking, I'm in big trouble here, man. I'm in big trouble. I don't know what to do with them if I catch them, but I'm in big trouble, right? I mean, I just know I'm in big trouble. And that certainly isn't the, and this is not going to be a religious talk, obviously, but certainly not religion's fault. It's that I can't hear it. I just can't hear that. I disqualify myself early on out of that with the belief that, you know, I'm disqualified for whatever reason because I'm thinking it is worse than doing it, so I'm out. And it's not like that I didn't try some kind of search for some kind of power that worked in my life. I have a friend who, I grew up in a little bitty town in southeast Oklahoma, a little town called Hugo. And one of my good friends in high school, her dad was the minister of the First Baptist Church there in Hugo. And I'll caveat this story, preface the story by telling you this, that Tina and I, who are still very good friends today, very good friends with my wife, she's clean and sober in the program of Celebrate Recovery 18 years. And that works for her. And I support that. And I'm her cheerleader. And I'm grateful that she has found a path. And she has been a light in that little community that I grew up in of 5,000 people. She has been a light in that community. And I've watched her take those little broken girls that come and do with them what we do here. Because they could hear it that way. The trouble for me is I just can't hear it that way. But we were sophomores in high school or juniors, I can't remember, and we sat by each other in Oklahoma history class. And she leaned over to me one day and she said, "Hey, Cliff, there's going to be a revival at the church this week. Would you like to go with me?" Now, if she'd have said, "Cliff, the Coors beer truck is going to be parked here tonight, we're going to go steal about 3 cases. It wouldn't have mattered. If anybody asked me to do anything, I was just so excited they would ask me. It didn't really matter what it was. I just want to be included. Isn't that how we are? I mean, really, it's how we are. We're that way as alcoholics. Lori, I remember I had a sponsor guy, and it was early in his sobriety, and he and his wife were going to be out of town. I think Lori and I were having a 4th of July party at the house for our group. For the men and women that we sponsor. And she said, "Well, we don't need to invite Phil because he's going to be in New York." I said, "Oh, no, 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 no. You invite him because he'll commit suicide if he doesn't get an invitation. Even though he's going to be out of town, he needs to know that he's invited, right? Because that's how we are. I need to know I'm included. I'm not coming, but I need to know I'm included, right? I mean, there's no way I'd go, but I need to be invited. Anyway, so she invited me to this revival. Now, some of you here today may have come from some kind of evangelical type religious experience in your background. And again, this is not a knock on that. So please hear me. This is my perception, right? Which we already know is delusional. So it's my perception. But I went to that revival with her because I'm excited to do anything with anybody. And they had this, and I don't know if you've ever been, for those of you who don't come from an evangelical type background, these revivals, you know, they have them in, and what that person's job is to collect as many souls for God as he possibly can for the weekend. That's their job, man, just to go harvest, and they're usually charismatic, and they're just powerful, very powerful presenters. And I'm sitting in the crowd, and I'm a lost ball in tall weeds, man. I mean, I have all that angst. Well, I got teenage angst, and I've got restless irritable discontent. I'm bedeviled. I've got all that. And this guy's just really good. Well, he makes an altar call. Well, hell, I'm all in. I mean, I'm in, you know. And so I go down, and I have this thought, a delusional thought afterwards. And by this time, I have this delusional thought that maybe I've been called to preach. Maybe that's my deal. I have a pulpit in the shadows today, but nonetheless. So I tell my friend, "Hey, you know, I think, because I'm just trying to find a spot." Right? And she said, "Well, you need to talk to my dad." And Dick was a wonderful man. Her father was a wonderful, just a wonderful man, kind, gentle. Gosh, just the kind of guy you really would want to be, the kind of man you'd want to be, you know. And I went and talked to Dick. He said, well, you need to talk to this guy who I can't even remember his name today. And so Dick sets up a dinner for me. And so I go have dinner with this evangelist. Now, I need to tell you, my mom, where I grew up and how I grew up, I was raised on a 160-acre cattle ranch farm. Whichever impresses you the most, that's where I was raised. And they also had a liquor store, which was convenient, by the way. But if you're going to talk to a Southern Baptist evangelist, probably ought to downplay the liquor store part. I'm just saying, right? And I was always embarrassed about that. My dad was a bootlegger before he bought the store and got legit. So I'm with dinner with this guy, and it's one of those pivotal moments. And I know you've had pivotal moments before sobriety and after sobriety. The book talks about those as turning points. Right? Step three, we stood at the turning point. We have these turning points in our lives. And I'm with this, and he's legitimately asking questions that you would ask of somebody of, tell me about yourself, tell me about, you know, tell me about your family. And so I begin to tell him. But I'm embarrassed about the liquor store. So it's like a throwaway. What I want you to hear is that we have this large conglomerate that I'm part of. And one of the divisions we have is a liquor business, right? I mean, it's a throwaway. And I remember that guy, when I tell him, and we have a liquor store, I remember him, he had a fork full of mashed potatoes, and there's one piece of corn dangling on it over here, right? Because I see it as clear as I see my beautiful wife. And I said, and it was like he double clutched, right? And he says to me, and it's a legitimate question. I mean, looking back at it from the perspective of all this time, it's a legitimate question. He looks at me and says, so you're telling me your family's in the liquor business and you think you've been called to preach? It's a legit question. But you may tell you what I heard on that day. See, because of who you are and where you come from, you'll never have God's grace. You'll never have God's grace. And that's the day that we parted companies. That's the day we parted companies. Now, what I know about that today is, you know, I should have been clued in when that guy Drew pulled up in a Mercedes. That's what I should have been clued in about. But I digress. But it's a turning point. It's a point in my life where my delusional thinking and what I hear because of how I perceive myself, that I'm less than, that I'm different from, it's absolutely the message that I got. And I'm going to tell you, my drinking ramped up. By the time I get to college, I'm a blackout drinker. But I'm on a mission. I have this. I'm still searching. I mean, I did whatever good disenfranchised Baptist does. I became Catholic at some point in time. Because I liked all their things they do. They're busy up front, man. And there was a stage in my drinking career when I used to decorate it. I was pretty damn busy, too. I'll tell you that, man. You know, I was pretty big on finding some accelerants to help me stay up late and drink longer, right? Gatorade for the drinking, man. That's what cocaine is, man. Our friend Bill says, if you're an alcoholic, didn't do cocaine, I'm sorry, right? And if you just did cocaine, you missed the point. That's the deal, right? So I liked all that ritual stuff, you know, because I used to have rituals, right? But I'm separated from God on self-will. And I think fundamentally when I look at my life and when I examine it, I am separated from God. On that day, I separate myself from God on self-will. And unconsciously, the thought I have is, whatever I'm going to get out of this world is going to be from whatever I create of it. It's not going to have anything to do with you. And if you do your thing, I'll do my thing, and never the twain shall mix. I can't tell you that I really thought that, but I sure began to act that way. I began to live my life as if there were no God. And our textbook talks about in the chapter, We Agnostics, this idea of old ideas, that I'm fraught with old ideas. And I drag those into Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I have all that old idea of a 16-year-old kid. From the perspective that I'm denied grace. And so I get that that might work for you. I understand that it might work for you. But gosh, you just don't understand. And isn't that all of our cases? Gosh, you just don't understand. We are so terminally unique. I need volumes written about me, really, you know. If they could do a 3-set volumes, that would be wonderful. But I'm so uniquely different that you don't understand. I really appreciated what Vivian said last night about the old man who took her through the book, and within 5 minutes she was through 1, 2, 3. I appreciate that. Because our book is very clear, I think, about what's wrong with me, and that is I lack power. I'm disconnected from the power. I am separated from God on self-will. I mean, I am separated from Him. And if I'm separated from God with self-will, and the book says I lack power, what is the solution for that? The solution is to get me connected to the power as quickly as possible. Is I've got to get to a source of power. Because my experience, and I don't know if it's yours or not, but my experience is this. If you separate me from alcohol and I have what everybody in the world perceives as bad things happen, we call that Tuesday, right? I mean, that's just... Step one without a step two and the rest of the steps, you know what that is? That's just another bad day in my life. Step one without the rest of the steps, certainly without 2 and 3, is just another bad day in my life of the alcoholic. And if you get me sober for a couple of days and all I have is sober, you get me out 2 or 3 days, you know what's going to happen? Man, this has been a gross overreaction on everybody's part. Not mine, but everybody else's, right? They don't understand. I'm back to that again. Somehow or another, this is your fault. The perspective of the non-drinker, if you stop drinking, your life will be okay. The perspective of the alcoholic, if y'all would just leave me alone, if you all would just get in line, if you all would just do what I need you to do, I'll be okay. Two diametrically opposed perspectives of the same problem, of the identical problem. It's like holding a $20 bill up here and asking this group to describe it. And this group to describe that one. And they're going to have two totally different perspectives of the $20 bill. Right? One's going to talk about the monument. One's going to talk about the man. And both are going to be right. But totally different perspectives. So when I wash up on the shores of Alcoholics Anonymous, an old man caught me. And he sat down on the day that God struck me sober on August the 15th of 2001. And he began to sing the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. Grace is what happens for us here. And it just doesn't happen for us here. I believe grace falls on everybody. I'm not so one way that I believe, aren't we the lucky ones? I don't believe that. I believe that grace fell upon us and somebody crawled through the window for us. Because what happens 2 or 3 days, we pull the window shut. God never shuts the window. I do. Why? Selfish and self-centered. That's the root of my problem. I get sober for 3 or 4 days. Worst thing to happen for an alcoholic, they get to feeling better, right? You get me feeling better without a solution, without somebody crawling through the window. You overreacted. That's not what I need. I've got a plan. I come up with a plan. And I love newcomer plans, by the way. They're wonderful, right? I remember one time I was at my home group and this kid, I was there early, and this kid pulled up, my buddy Terry, who's my best friend in AA at home. We're litter mates. We're a couple months apart in sobriety. I got sober in August. He got sober in December. And Terry was trying to sponsor this guy, John, and he comes early. And I said, hey, man, how's it going? He says, oh, pretty good. I'm waiting on Terry. I said, oh, okay. What's going on? He said, well, my girlfriend and I have been talking, and I'm just going to go back to church. And I said, hey, man, you don't have to wait on him to resign. I'll take the resignation right here. I mean, I'll take it, right? Go do what you got to do, right? I'm an encourager of newcomer plans. Why? Because that's what our book tells us to do. If you got a better way, go do that. Try that. You can always call me. I always try to leave it friendly. Hey, man, I understand. If you think working out and stuff is going to be better for you, then go do that. Go try that. You're always welcome to call me. We find it helpful here to talk to another drunk. you know, come when you can. I got a kid in treatment now. He was trying to, you know, he was come to AA and he's trying to get sober. And I said, look, man, come if you want. Don't come. I'm your friend whether you're drunk or sober. Don't come here and begrudgingly have a resentment on AA. Just go do what you got to do. And he's in treatment now. And he called me. So I got to get back to AA, right? I got to leave it friendly. But I'm an encourager of newcomer plans. I mean, if you got a plan, then you got to run that out, because always in the back of your mind will be the lurking notion our book tells us we've got to be rid of. We've got to be rid of any lurking notion. But Don sat that day knee to knee with me, and he shared the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. And every day, I think for all of us in our lives, there's a moment in time when we have that implosion of self. Consequences don't really do it for us. If consequences, external consequences, if they were the factor of getting people like us sober, the first time we got in trouble, we'd stop. The first time we crossed any hurdle that we believe was major, we'd have stopped. We said, whoa, I'm out. And I know this to be a fact because I have a friend of mine that she was at a bridal shower and she drank a little too much and she got pulled over and she had one glass of champagne too much. And they took her down and my God, she had got a DUI and she was mortified. And she's like, I'm never drinking again. And you know what? She hasn't. Right? Me, I would blame the taillight guy who fixed it all that. I'm just going to Uber everywhere. I mean, right? When I tell people about it, well, I'm so sorry. You know, when I say I'm sorry, I'm never doing that again. I just mean I'm not going to do that. I'm going to drink, but I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that again. We'll find a way around that. But on that day where Don talked to me, grace fell on me, and I had an implosion of self, which I believe is necessary. This internal implosion of self, where self got obliterated for a moment. And Don crawled through the window of grace, and he brought me a beneficial message of hope. I'm a guy that will complicate step two. This idea of coming to believe, you know, it's past tense, came to believe that a power could restore us to sanity. There's this idea that something out there can help me. And the book says that that's my problem. I'm somehow disconnected from that. And I have if the book says there's one who has all power, and it says that one is God, may you find him now. If that one has all power, then I'm zero. And I'm this kid, this idea, you know, our textbook talks about this. If I just had a better philosophy of life, if I just live by a better moral code, I'm going to tell you something. I had that. I had parents that instilled that in me. You know, while my mom and dad owned a liquor store, I could count on one hand the times I saw them take a drink. My dad had this philosophy that he tried to imprint on me. He said, this is to sell, not to drink. Right? I mean, that was his belief. And if I saw them drink, and when I would see them drink, it would be this. Either my dad would be out working cattle, and he'd get a beer and pop, a cold beer and pop it and drink half of it. And yeah, I know. You could always tell the people who identify me. And, they'd get, and drink half of it and get his thirst quenched and throw the other half away. That's alcohol abuse in this room. I know that, man. But they taught me, they gave me a good moral code. They taught me all that stuff, right from wrong. But man, I'm just one of these kids that lack power to put that in my life. I lack power to put the right action in my life. It far transcends the booze problem. When our book talks about the spiritual malady, you know, we find the salve, but we're allergic to that. And then we get into this horrible obsession, spree, remorse, repeat that Silkworth talked about. It's the salve for us. But it's beyond that for me. Lacking power. I lack power to make the right decision. I mean, I could be walking down the hall and a sign says wet paint. And my thought is it really? Let me see. Yeah. Don't touch this button. Why? I mean, what happens when we touch the button, right? The whole world going, okay, down here we're going to go right. The first thought I have is, I wonder what's left. I'm going to catch up later. I'm going to go over here. See, I cannot take those practical principles and put them into my life. I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to take fundamental right action when it's crucial and necessary. I don't know how to do that. I know it intellectually, but in my heart. And if you're here this weekend, one of the things I really want to impress upon you and try to encourage you is not listen with your head this weekend. Try to listen with your heart. Because I've never been changed by intellectual information. That's good. When I have experienced a transformation is when I've been touched in my heart, when my emotions has been changed, and I become aware. And in that awareness, in the awareness, I see myself change. So I lack power. And the day that Don sat with me, he just looked at me and said, "Do you hope what's working for me can work for you?" See, I believe today, looking back on that experience, that that's as simple as step two has to be for us. But I want to complicate it. I love that part that Matt read today out of our book. That is such a beautiful piece of that book, and it's a piece that will set alcoholics free. You know, when Ebby sat across from Bill and he said, just choose your own conception, if you think about where Ebby was at that time, I mean, part of the Oxford group, it was a Jesus deal, right? I mean, he's a carrier for Jesus, right? But on that day, he takes a total different flip. Just come up with your own conception. Right? And that piece that Matt read frees a guy like me because it further says that this God which I can neither comprehend nor define. And I can't tell you how much time I've wasted trying to put God in a box, trying to get some kind of understanding. Some of the great mystics say that, you know, God is not in the known but in the unknown. And it's in the unknown where we find God. And it seemed so simple that day when Don said that to me. Do you hope what's working for me can work for you? And isn't that really the essence of our step two here? Hope. And what I did was I just started following Don around. And I think for all of us at various stages, perhaps, maybe I'm unique in the idea that Don became my first higher power. My first sponsor became my first higher power because he was sober and he was talking to me about how he drank, how he felt, and what had happened to him since he stopped drinking and got connected to this power. And when he said, "Do you hope that'll work for you?" I thought, "I hope so." And I'm like some kind of high stakes poker player. You know, I just push all my AA chips to the middle of the table and go all in on AA. Vivian said this yesterday, and it's absolutely true that great spiritual teachers have told us for years, for centuries. We live life forward, we understand it backwards. I don't think I need to give a newcomer any 4-hour lecture on God. I used to think that. I used to think I need to give people spiritual enemas. You know, I'm just going to, if I can get this book inserted right, they'll get it, you know. I read another piece of our book one time, which opened up my world again. It says that if a man's to find God, it must come from within. That there's nothing that I can do to allow you to have a conversion experience. There's nothing I can do to allow you to have a transformative experience. What I can do is share my experience. And if you identify with that, because that's what Don did with me, if you can identify that, then maybe you'll hook in. The greatest thing we have, this identification in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then if maybe my experience or the experience of thousands of others, you'll begin to become aware and awake and begin to have a transformational experience. And so what I believe for me is that was all it was necessary, because the book tells that even a willingness to believe. Do you now believe? Are you willing to believe? You know, you just got to be a little bit suspicious around here, I think. I mean, at the end of the day, I got to be suspicious this might work for me. And what happens over time, because what happened for me was like, I don't know, I was about 90 days sober, and a guy comes up to me and he said, "Oh, guy, Cliff, how long have you been sober now?" And I've calculated up whatever it was at the time. And in that moment when I calculated that time, it hit me that I hadn't thought about drinking in 90 days. That in that moment in time when Don talked to me, now I know this is not everybody's experience, it certainly wasn't Dr. Bob's experience. But at that moment in time when Don talked to me and I heard what he said, I heard him. I'd been going to AA because Lori had kicked me out of the house. So when I came to AA that summer of 2001, I didn't have an alcohol problem. That was not it. I had a homelessness problem. That was why I was coming to AA. I'm going to garner support and get back in the house, right? Maybe get back in the big bed, get some crossover privileges every once in a while, right? I'm trying to. I don't come to AA to get sober. I come to AA to get back in the house. And if you're new, you're nearly new here today. Hear this. You don't have to come to AA to want to get sober here. I mean, that's my experience. I didn't come here with any plan that, my God, my life is, I really need to go to AA. That's not why I came here, man. I came to AA to abuse it. So I could tell Lori and just use it as long as I could till I could get back in the house. No intention to get sober. But this is miracle territory here. And if you're in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're in God's territory. God never could reach me out there. When I'm twisting and shouting out there, he never had a shot at me. But in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, God had a shot at me. And on that day, he used one of his best agents, right, to crawl through the window and grab me and give me just a little bit of hope and willingness to perhaps this might work for me. And over time, what happened is that I became to have a relationship with this power that I can neither comprehend or define. And I got to tell you, the longer I'm here, the more I don't know. What a blessing that is. You know, I think I need to know everything. You know, I'm an intellectual. That's what I think I am. But I'm not sure what the hell I am. But I think I am, you know. It's more important that you think I am than I think I am, right? Or what I think you think I am. That may be critical. But I pride myself to being some kind of smart guy. And I think I've got to know. And what I've learned here is that what I need to be here in Alcoholics Anonymous is I need to really, what our book talks about, I need to not grow up spiritually. I need to grow down spiritually to the faith of a child. How many times have we gone past something like this and the kid be on something like this and you walk by and they say, catch me, and they just jump. They don't wait. Are you ready? Right? Catch me. They're in the air when they say it, man. They have this unbelievable faith and belief that you're going to catch them. They just have this internal condition that they just trust. The world hadn't got to them yet. We haven't infected them with fear. We haven't infected them with worldly clamor. They're innocent. And they just believe if I jump, they're going to catch me. Isn't that what God asked me to do? Every day. Every day, God gives me an opportunity to stand on the precipice of faith and belief. And he asked me to jump. Just jump, man. I got you. Fear, the evil and corroding thread. Fear, low-grade atheism. Worry, doubt, low-grade atheism. Today is the day. Rachel and I were talking about it last night. Well, today, I know for those 65 years God's been good to me, but today's the day, right? I know he drug me out of the toilet, but today's the day that I'm going to get dunked in the ocean and I ain't making it out, right? But that's the deal for us. Low-grade atheism, fear, worry, doubt permeates that. And so the decision we have to make in step three is am I going to live by that fear that kept me prisoner for all those years prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous? Am I going to be that person that is a time traveler, right? I love time travel, man. I'm digging it, man. I like to get out in the future, get worried about stuff, you know, right? I like to do that. How's it going to all shake out for me? For me. Screw you. How's it shaking out for me? Oh, I like to go in the past. The past is great, isn't it? You get to wallow in self-pity back there, man. You just coulda, woulda, shouldas. You're just back there and terrorizing yourself, right? Low-grade atheism. Low-grade atheism. Low-grade agnosticism. Ever fear, worry, and doubt, not, it's just disloyalty to God. And I'm a disloyal guy. I'm not up here telling you that, maybe one day you'll rise to my level. I'm sharing this with you because it's my experience is that I get that. And every time when I share that with somebody that, hey, I'm worried today, I'm in a lot of fear today, you know what they do? Well, just be where your feet are. And you know what happens when I'm where my feet are? If I can get my mouth and my feet going in the same direction, you know what happens for me? Everything, everywhere is already okay. In this moment, we're all okay. Doesn't matter what's going on in life or how bad my head wants to make it out. I got to tell you something. Probably 99.9% of everything I've ever thought was going to happen has never happened. But I forget that. In the one-tenth of 1%, I forget it. I rely on that experience. And what God, I believe, it calls us to do in this third step is to look at this, make a decision. That I'm making a decision that I'm going to, you know, our book talks about abandon. You ever really looked at the word abandon? You ever thought about abandon? What it really means? It talks to us about abandoning ourselves to God. You ever really thought about what abandon means? We kick around surrender here a lot, concede, but abandon. If you got an old junk car and you haul it off to the scrap yard and the guy says, what are you doing? I said, I'm abandoning my car here. Are you going back to get it? No, I'm leaving it behind. That's what God calls us to do. Abandon ourselves to God. That's the essence of the third step. To abandon myself. It's like jumping out of the airplane. I'm skydiving. I'm jumping out of the airplane. How am I going to jump back in? I mean, once I'm out, how do I get back in, right? I'm out. And I'm just going to tell you, I'm a guy that tries to claw back to the plane. I'm trying to swim in the air to try to get back in the plane, right? I'm a guy that's, you know, that is, has waves of fear. I'm a guy that will wallow in self-pity. I'm a guy that will time travel. That's why I have a sponsor. That's why I have friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I call a guy like Ben or Bill or Steve and say, man, I'm in a spot today. You know, here's my reality at the moment. But it's not reality. It's my perception of reality. And in reality, once again, in reality, I stand on the precipice, and God says, just jump, man. Just jump. If I look at my life and looking at how I interacted with people in my life, when I read that part in our book about step three, those four things, you know, that it talks about first, the first requirement, any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. But if I look at my life, I've lived myself that way my whole life. From that time that old preacher said that to me, this idea that I'm just got whatever I wrest out of this world is going to be on my own making. It's just going to be up to me. I've just got to do it on my own. And I think the third step is so critical for us to look at. And on that day where Don said to me, do you hope? You know, he just said, okay, we're going to do the prayer. And he got on my knee. We got on our knees. We did the third step prayer right there. And then he gave me instructions on the fourth step. Then he said, I want you at my house. We're going to read gave me some reading assignments. So I want you to be at my house tonight, and we're going to start going through the book, and I'm talking to you about it. But he got me busy in action, knowing that he was going to catch me up on why. And Don would catch me up on why we're doing it. But he would give me reading assignments, and I would go to his house, and then he would have me read out loud to him, like he didn't trust me that I read it, you know? Crazy. Right? I do the same thing with the people today because I don't trust them, right? But it's so important to have somebody explain it to you. Because this book was written in Russian. I only understand Vietnamese, so it's important to have a translator, right? I got to have a translator. It's vital. I need to know the history. I need to know why we do things, how this happened. Very important for me. But if I look at my life, if I really look back on it, on that moment in time, that turning point when I was a kid at 16 years old, and I made this decision at that time to turn away from God, whatever it was, I'm getting it on my own. And I lay that over what our textbook talks about, how it really lays out how my life looks. Because what happens for me is that I need everything to turn out the way that I need it to turn out. Suddenly, I begin to play God in my life, but more importantly, I begin to play God in your life. Right? I'm the frustrated actor who really wants to be a director. You know, and I'm going to use my good friend Rachel today because I just always make amends to her later for this. And Alex, I'll have to make amends to Alex too. But in my life, if Rachel and I met each other And I thought, well, I kind of like Rachel, you know. And for some godforsaken reason, she kind of liked me. I just take her hostage, man. I mean, let's take her hostage, right? She's mine. And I'm one of those guys that, you know, because I'm alcoholic, we just go underground for about 60 days, you know. But eventually, you got to get back to the world, you know. And we go back to the world, and we get to a room of some people gathered like this, and I begin to notice some things about Rachel. When we get into a crowd like this, I notice that she doesn't stand as close to me as the role I've assigned her. Right? I notice if it was only just men in the room and the women were all gone, she doesn't hold my hand as quickly as the role calls for. Right? But I'm not unsympathetic. I mean, I try to help her. I mean, you know, I encourage her. I try to be encouraging as the director of her life. Right? I try to be encouraging. But if she doesn't get it, I'll just be a jerk to get her to move where I need her to move to fulfill the role that I've assigned her. And what happens after a time, I've got to keep helping her do that, then I become disenfranchised. The star power she had at one time begins to fade. And so I start looking for understudies to help her. Right? She finds out about the understudies. She's not very happy. And she says something like this, I'm out of here, which she should have, right? And you know what I say? Good. Good. You know why? You don't get it, right? Because you should know how it should look to be in my life. You should know that. And then I have the greatest fear of every alcoholic pervades me, just permeates my whole body after about 10 minutes. Oh, my God, I'm going to be alone the rest of my life, right? And I got to have somebody right now. That's my life story. And I wish I could just tell you that that's how it looked in my romantic relationships. The romantic relationships is the easiest one for me to see. Because in my romantic relationships, I'm a hostage taker. And I want her to conform and love me the way I need to be loved, but I'm not telling her how that is. It's a script, and by God, she just should know. Right? And I wish I could just tell you it was that. But I did that with my parents. If you're going to be my parents, this is how I need to be parented. This is what I need in my life. I don't tell them that. But I just browbeat them till I get it. This is how it looks to be my friend. I assign you a role, and when you don't live up to the role, I browbeat you till you do it, or I'm out. And my whole life has been that way. I don't understand selfishness, self-centered. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and they said, Cliff, list the top 100 problems of your life, maybe you're like me. Selfishness, self-centered, they don't even make the list, do they? Really? I mean, really. If you're really honest. When you get here, does selfishness, self-centered even pop on the radar? Hell no, we're givers here, man. We're givers. That's my perception. That's the perception of my life. I'm a giver, but always with a hook. Right? I'm like Don Corleone. Someday, I may ask you to do a favor for me, right? Or you could have a horse head in your bed. I don't know, right? But if I look at my life, and this is why step three and understanding what step three looks at, why I need to see how I've been the central God character in my life and your life. Why is that so important? Why is it so fundamentally important? Because it sets the table for what Leslie's going to talk about. That I've got to internalize what step three really says to me. Because it is so critical for that. That our book talks about, man, that is the cornerstone for us. If we struggle here, we're going to struggle with everything in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to struggle with everything in life. We're going to struggle with everything. It's a foundation built on sand. Because when I get to step four, oh my God, the evidence begins to become real. The evidence, I mean, the verdict is in. The evidence is in, oh my God, I really have been playing God in people's lives. I have been trying to impose my will on you to do and act the way I think you should do and act to make me happy. And the truth is, I don't really care how you are. There's the unfortunate and unmitigated truth for me. I don't really care. It's the fundamental thing that I'm happy. and that I get what I want. And gosh, I've got to see that. And I've got to see that that has been a destructive force in my life. The 12 and 12 talks about that for people like me, that my real fundamental problem is defective human relationships. Because I've been trying to impose my will on you my entire life. If you'll do this, then I'll be happy. You know, I somehow believe that happiness lies out there. I somehow believe, because I think the world tells me, if I can get the picture to look right, I'll be okay. And gosh, just turn on your TV set from the time you were a kid, if we just reflect on it. The advertising industry has figured this out for years. If you drive this car, if you have a woman or man that looks like this, if you have this much money, if you live in this neighborhood, you'll be happy. Everything tells me that it's out here. And so the message I get, if I can get this to look right, I'll be okay. Trouble, I live in Oklahoma. We have strong winds. You people blow all over the place, man. You know, I can't get you to stay anywhere from me. And I am eternally restless, irritable, and discontent because you move on me. You change positions. You don't do it right. And it just stirs up all that spiritual malady that I've got. I get restless, irritable, discontent. All the beliefs come back. I'm less than, I'm separate from, and I'm back in that obsession, spree, remorse, repeat. I'm in this dynamics. And so what Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me, and through good sponsorship and watching good people like you in Alcoholics Anonymous, what it's taught me here is to grow down, that spiritually grow down to the faith of a child. Because I think for a guy like me, that when I look at this cornerstone, this piece of Alcoholics Anonymous, these first three steps, I think the real deal is when we get to these steps and we get through them, I think unbeknownst to us, there's a conversation that happens with God. And I think God looks at us and says something like this: well, Cliff, here you are. You've made it all the way to Alcoholics Anonymous, man. Right? You admit this powerless and unmanageability of your life? And gosh, I'm standing at that turning point again. Right? I'm at that spot. Yeah, I do. My life is unmanageable. I am powerless. I really am. I think God looks at us as, okay, all right. And are you willing to consider, be suspicious about my existence? You willing just to consider? And I think in our brokenness, you know, where the light creeps in, right? In the cracks is where the light creeps in. You got darkness in a room. You don't sweep it out with a broom. You turn the light on, right? Turn the light on. He looks at us and says, you willing to consider my existence? And in that moment, in our brokenness, we say, yeah, I'm willing to be suspicious about that. I'm willing to consider that you're the powerful one, that you got the power, that somehow or another that you can get these insane ideas out of my head, that somehow you can come into my life and restore me to this idea of sanity. And God looks at us and he said, and are you willing to try to conform to my will? Are you willing to just try to the best of your ability to turn your will and your life over to me? Are you willing just to try that? Are you willing to try to go out and live your life on a different basis? Are you willing just to give it your best efforts, man? I'm not asking for perfection. I'm just asking for spiritual progress here. Are you willing to try some spiritual progress with me? And gosh, in our brokenness, we say yes. Yes. And I think in that moment, in that exact moment in time, God looks at us and he says this: we're good. We are good. We're good. We're good. There's nothing else I need to do. I don't need to get any better. I don't need to wait till next week when I'm a few more days sober. I think God, the book tells us, meets us right where we are. And in that moment, when we concede those three things, those first three steps in our life, God says, buddy, we're good. You and I are good. You don't need to worry anymore. I got you. We are good. And then he looks at us and said, and now we're going to talk about who's been sitting in the God chair, right? We're going to talk about who's been sitting in the God chair. You guys have been extraordinarily kind to me this morning. To sit and listen to me this morning. And I'm extraordinarily grateful for that. I've had a tough week. And if Christy hadn't already had a couple people bail on her, I might have bailed on her this weekend. I just had a really, really hard week. And I came here with... I left Oklahoma City just so incredibly sad. So incredibly sad. But God's perfect timing for me, you know? The extraordinary sadness that I felt this week, this just gut-wrenching sadness that Lori and I both have experienced this week. I cried on the airplane out here. But the power you have here, your presence, with God in the mix, what happens is that God's perfect timing. While I was set home full of self-pity and wallowing self-pity, all about me again. What happened when I got here is that Ben got here and he just grabbed me up and he said, come on, we're going to go walking. And what happened is that you guys started showing up. And God started putting me right in the places that I needed to be. Once again, God's perfect timing. No matter what the situation in my life, no matter what's happening in my life, I have to always fundamentally come back to one thing. I'm standing on the precipice, and God only asked me one thing. Cliff, just jump. Just jump. Thanks for having me.